Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history with Liz Covart. The study of history is key to understanding who we are and how we can affect a better future. Ben Franklin's World will introduce you to historical people and events that have impacted and shaped our present-day world. And now, here's your host, Liz Covart.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 10 of Ben Franklin's World, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn more about how the people and events of our early American past have shaped the present-day world we live in. Each week, we sit down with an historian to discuss their unique insights into our early American past so we can learn more about who we are and how we can affect a better future. I have a question for you. When I say the War for American Independence, what images do you picture in your mind? I bet that you see pictures of George Washington, the Continental Congress, or perhaps specific battlefields or encampment sites. You may even see glimpses of the bedraggled but proud Continental soldiers, or perhaps the Continentals taking on the redcoats of the British Army on the field of battle. In this episode, we will focus on those British redcoats as Don N. Haggist leads us on an exploration of the British Army and the men who served in its ranks. In today's episode, Don will reveal whether the myth that the British Army represented the dregs of British society holds true, how many men served in the British Army during the American War for Independence, and how the Army recruited them, and how the British Army became one of the best fighting forces in the late 18th century. As a bonus, Don will also reveal more information about how the British Army came to include thousands of German soldiers, or Hessians, soldiers that the Continentals despised even more than the British redcoats. But first, I would like to wish you a Happy New Year. In a couple of days, we will begin 2015. Now, I am sorry to see 2014 go because it has been a fun and exciting year for me. I had the opportunity to travel, to meet new people, and to start this podcast. Although I am sad to see 2014 go, I am excited about 2015, as I have a lot of great projects and goals in mind for the coming year. One goal is that I hope to finish my book manuscript and ship America's First Gateway off to the publishers. I don't know if I'll meet that goal, but it is a goal that I have for the upcoming year. I also have this podcast. Starting the first week of January, Ben Franklin's World will become a weekly program. Now, this is an ambitious goal, but I'm organized, committed, and enthusiastic. So I can't wait to explore more of the people, places, and events of our early American history with you. What are you excited about in 2015? Do you have any resolutions, trips, or goals planned? I hope you'll share them with me. Please let me know by sending an email to liz@benfranklinsworld.com or tweet me at Liz Covart. Okay, without further ado, here is Don N. Haggist and the British Army.
With tidings and wisdom to share about our early American past, here is this week's special guest.
We welcome Don N. Haggist, an editor of the Journal of the American Revolution and an independent scholar specializing in the demographics and material culture of the British Army in the American Revolution. Don maintains a blog about British common soldiers called Redcoat 76. He has also published several academic journal articles and four books, the most recent of which is British Soldiers, American War, Voices of the American Revolution. Although a practiced historian, Don has a far different day job. During the day, Don works as an engineering consultant for technology companies in Rhode Island. Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, Don.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I have to admit, engineering and history aren't two things I normally put together.
Well, a lot of people don't, but there's the place where there's the crossover is in analysis of data. And we'll probably talk about this a little more when we get into details of the book. But when I look at personal stories of an individual in history, I want to put it in context by saying, you know, how did this person fit into their world? And to understand the world, we need a lot of data.
We can't look at just two people and say, well, 18th century British soldiers were like that. We have to look at very large numbers and understand how to really process demographic data to understand a population that we're looking at. So in that sense, my engineering training to take a real critical analytical look at large quantities of data dovetails very well with my interest in history.
Don, I think you just gave my parents an excuse to pester me to change professions. They probably think I'd be a better retirement fund for them if I were an engineer.
Well, it's ironic that I often will counsel people not to major in history unless they're sure that they can be incredibly good at it, because it's not an easy field to find a good job in. Whereas if you're a software engineer or a chemical engineer or something, there's plenty of good jobs and you can still do history work.
It's true. Historians have a lot of valuable skill sets. And like you said, I hadn't really considered its parallels with engineering, but there are some parallels. Even if you do decide you want to study history because you're that passionate about it, you can train for different fields using the skills that you acquire.
Absolutely.
So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you became interested in British soldiers during the American Revolution?
Well, that's a great question. And, as a child, I was very interested in military history. I loved looking at the books with pictures of airplanes and ships and whatnot. And I found I gravitated most toward personal stories. I liked reading autobiographical accounts of individuals who were in military situations. When the bicentennial of the American Revolution came around, I was still quite young, but of course that swept up everybody's interest. And as I looked at the American Revolution, even, with very youthful eyes, I found what drew me in most was the military science and also the heraldry, the fancy uniforms and the discipline. Well, the British Army at that time was the professional army that in many ways the fledgling American army tried to emulate. So as somebody interested in those details of the military history, I gravitated toward learning more about the British, about the discipline, the tactics, the uniforms, the equipment. The British Army had it all. They were the high-tech modern army of the era. Well, when I started trying to really learn more about it, I found two problems. One, that there wasn't very much good literature on the subject. And even worse, when I looked at the literature that was available, there were a lot of contradictions that didn't make very much sense at all. Now, on the one hand, it talked about this being a high-quality professional army that was keeping the peace or trying to keep the peace in a worldwide empire. But on the other hand, you'd read stories about brutal discipline and soldiers being conscripted and forced to serve against their will. And it didn't really seem to add up very well. So the thing that anybody with a research inclination does is goes right to the primary source. When you find that the standard books aren't making sense to you, then it's time to turn to real research.
It's interesting that you mentioned stereotypes and things that were missing in the literature that talked about the truth of the British Army. And one stereotype that we often hear is that the British soldiers represented the dregs of British society: drunkards, criminals, the homeless, and uneducated. Is this an accurate picture of the soldiers who served in the British Army? And was there a typical background for British soldiers?
Well, to answer the first question, it's an almost complete myth that the British soldiers were from the dregs of society. British society was quite a continuum from its own dregs to its upper classes. Great Britain during this era had a thriving middle class, and we tend to forget that today and think it was a much more two-tiered society when really it was a continuum. And British common soldiers came from almost every place on that spectrum of society. They were mostly lower middle class to middle class citizens who gravitated toward the army for the very same kinds of reasons that people gravitate toward joining the army today. It was a stable career. The pay, while not great, was reasonable, and at least the pay was guaranteed once you were a soldier, unlike the large amounts of itinerant and temporary labor that was available during the era. The occupation of a soldier in Great Britain was one of the very, very few professions that offered a pension if you served for a long career. So it had a lot of attractive aspects to it. So the men who joined, when we're looking at a society, we can't really say, well, British soldiers were any one thing. But when we generalize the background, we found that slightly over half of British soldiers were men who had served an apprenticeship through their teen years, and sometime after their apprenticeship ended, they either started a career that they decided that they hated, or chose not to start a career at all and joined the army instead. So about 55 or so percent of the soldiers had practiced some kind of a skilled trade before joining the army. The remaining 45% or so tended to be agricultural laborers. Now, when you look at list of trades, you see the term laborer, and that can mean a lot of different things, but in an agrarian society, it tends to mean somebody who worked the farms and fields.
Are you finding those statistics of occupation on muster rolls, or are you finding that in some other document?
To study British soldiers, there are a few large collections of documents that provide a broad spectrum of data. One of the key ones is pension records. Now, of British soldiers who served in America during the Revolution, about a quarter of them ended up receiving pensions. Now, this wasn't because a quarter of the soldiers who served in America were the only ones considered. It was when you serve as a soldier for your entire 20 or 30 year career. This war in America was a maximum of 8 years out of that. Many of these men died in the service later on or ran into other circumstances that prevented them ever becoming eligible to get a pension. If you look at the men who were eligible to get pensions, then the number who got pensions was something over half. And I say something over because there are some challenges in determining the exact number. The pension records tell us a man's demographic information, where he was born, how old he was, what his trade was. So that's the major source of this data. And then there are a number of other smaller collections that tell us, perhaps for a single regiment at one given time, what the trades and ages and other demographic data was.
So myth busted. The British soldiers
Absolutely.
Did not represent the dregs of society. So let's try for another one. Another stereotype that we often hear is that the British Army stood as the most well-trained and most disciplined army in the world by the end of the French and Indian War, which took place between 1754 and 1763. Don, is this true? And if so, how did the Army train its soldiers to such high levels of professionalism?
Well, that one I'll maintain is true. Now, when you say who's got the best army in the world, it's pretty hard to quantify that to any level of detail. But the British Army was a very high-quality fighting force by the end of the French and Indian War. And it achieved that primarily because it was composed mostly of professional soldiers. These men joined the army for the most part in their early 20s after they had already tried some other career. And if you want another myth that we can debunk right now, the British Army was an all-volunteer force.
Oh,
now, there's
no
some minor exceptions that we'll get into later, but for the most part, almost all of the British soldiers who served in America were volunteers. They weren't in the army against their will. They joined the army as a career by their own choice. Right away, you've laid the groundwork for a very high quality fighting force. The British Army was not a large army at peacetime. The whole structure was designed to have a small, very high quality army that you could then supplement in times of war. Does that speak to your question to some extent?
Yes, it certainly does. And when you say that they had to increase the number of soldiers during times of war, how did the Army go about recruiting soldiers?
Well, there are several ways that it did it. The Army, because it was an established Army, unlike the American Army during the Revolution that had to be created almost from scratch, the British had a standing Army. So all of the mechanics of recruiting and logistics, paying for the soldiers, getting supplies and clothing to places where they were needed, that was all well established. In peacetime, it operated in a small way, and then in wartime, it was expanded. Individual British regiments, when I talk about a regiment, I'm talking about a deployable force of about 500 men. British regiments did their own recruiting. So they sent individual officers, usually with a drummer and a couple of soldiers, to any place in Great Britain where they thought that men might be recruited. They were able to give a recruiting bounty that amounted to, I'm going to say, about a half a year's pay. You know, how much it was depends on what your job was. But you could get a fairly good enlistment bounty. And the recruiting parties went to places in the country at times of year when they thought there would be men available looking for work. So they went to town market fairs, they went to harvest festivals, they went to other places where people gathered, and they beat up for recruits, beat the drums. Men enlisted by their own choice in the regiment of their choice. And knowing full well that this was going to be a career, once a man made the commitment to enlist, he had 4 days to go before a magistrate to testify before a judge that he did, in fact, enlist voluntarily. So there was a check and a balance to make sure he wasn't duped into serving.
Well, this is a very different picture than I had previously of what British soldiers were. I mean, these were a professional crew. They were volunteer. They weren't impressed or forced into duty. And the recruitment sounds pretty fair. But another question I have about recruitment is, we know during the American Revolution, the British military had German soldiers. Did these soldiers fight in British units or in separate units? Were British Army officers recruiting in Germany? Can you tell us more about these Germans who served in the British Army?
And another great question, because there are actually two separate components to this. The Germans that we're familiar with serving in the American Revolution, we usually call Hessians. And this is where, when the British Army needed to fight a war, it looked to augment its size to have enough troops to fight that war. One of the ways to do this was to engage an ally. Now, a lot of people call their Hessian soldiers mercenaries, which is a sort of misuse of the word, at least in modern terms, because mercenary soldiers are ones who come from a foreign government and get paid directly by the foreign government to fight for them. In this case, the Germans who are fighting in America can be considered more of allies to the British. The British government needed more troops. They went to individual German princes, and the government paid the principalities to send troops to America. So the troops themselves were German soldiers serving their individual principalities, following orders given to them. They weren't mercenary troops by any stretch. That's the majority of the Germans. However, another thing that the British government did when they needed more recruits, once they realized that this is a real war we have to fight in America, we have to rapidly increase the size of the army, they sent an officer into continental Europe to get some number of recruits, and he recruited some 2,000 or so individuals from mostly German states, but there were some Swedes and Frenchmen and Yugoslavia, you know, a number of different people from a number of different countries who he recruited. Some of them were men who had prior military experience and some were not. These men were integrated into existing British regiments. So by October and November of 1776, if you took any given British regiment in America, a regiment of about 500 men, among its ranks, you'll find anywhere between 40 and in a few cases as many as 100 European soldiers in it. Well, for the most part, we call them German soldiers because most of them were from German states. But there are foreigners serving in the ranks of British regiments.
Boy, we have a diverse army force that I didn't know. I mean, I guess I just assumed they were all British. So that is really interesting.
No, the majority were, in fact, British, but there were quite a number that weren't. And the army was very skilled at accommodating these different backgrounds and languages. There's a lot still to be discovered on it about on the individual level of how these things were managed. Soldiers who didn't speak the same language, for example.
Did they have officers who spoke German, or did that lead to confusion, or did they give them a crash course in English?
Well, this is one of the areas where more research still needs to happen. Most British officers, and again, this is a very challenging to say most because we don't know the numbers, but most of them were classically trained individuals, so they spoke English and they probably spoke French pretty well, maybe even a little Latin. Now here come these German recruits who speak German, or they might speak Swedish, or they might speak French or Russian. How they were trained and how they served through this language barrier, we don't really know because we don't have a lot of detailed data that gets down onto that level. We do know that when court martials occurred, interpreters were sometimes appointed, and I see cases where sometimes the interpreter was a German speaking English and sometimes he was a British soldier speaking German. So there were certainly some number of bilingual and multilingual men in the ranks of the army. But how prevalent that was, we don't know. And we have to bear in mind that the British Army faced the same issue with Gaelic Scots and Gaelic Irish, who also didn't speak English as their native language.
So it's a multicultural and multilingual army.
It absolutely is. Although, again, it is primarily English-speaking and primarily British and particularly English-British, but it does have quite a number of these other nationalities and cultures in the ranks.
So now that you've provided us with a great overview of what the entire army looked like, let's get into the details of your book, British Soldiers, American War, in which you use nine British soldiers to showcase the diverse nature of the army and the soldiers' experience. Don, how many British soldiers served in the army during the American War for Independence?
I usually give the number of 50,000 individual British soldiers who served in America. Now, that number is plus or minus 20% because it's challenging to count the exact numbers. We can look at muster rolls and there's some vagaries. We have cases where men serve in one regiment, they get captured, they escape, they join another regiment, they start serving there. So just looking at strength returns from year to year doesn't give a good picture of how many individuals. I have some math in one of my footnotes that explains how I came up with the 50,000 number, but it's an estimate. So 50,000 or so, of whom we have these personal stories of nine of them presented in the book.
And how and why did you choose those nine accounts for your book?
I chose those nine accounts for the book because there are a total right now of 11 known accounts by British soldiers who served in America. Accounts of any length, long enough to make a chapter in a book from them. It's very sad to me and puzzling that in an army where the literacy rate was somewhere between 50 and 75%, we have real memoirs or personal narratives of only 11 men out of some 50,000. I don't know why that's the case. I'm hoping that there's still more out there to be found. Two of the surviving narratives, the two that aren't in this book, are themselves book-length narratives, which is why they're not in here. The other nine are long enough to be a chapter in a book. One of the accounts in the book is an autobiographical letter, so the account by itself isn't very long. A couple of the other soldiers wrote long memoirs of their whole lives, and from them I extracted just the portion that covers their career as a British soldier.
And I know that there are 9 narratives, but can you pick one or two and give us a preview of the kind of characters you talk about?
Sure. I have to think for just a moment to decide to choose a few, because people ask me which one I like best, and the answer is all of them. One of my favorites is a young soldier named Thomas Watson, and I like him because he breaks a lot of the stereotypes. Thomas Watson was a young man who was born in Cheshire in northwestern England, and rather than go into a trade when he was 7 years old, he had to go start working. There's those men who weren't from family backgrounds where you could go into a trade, well, then you go to work or you go to school. He went to work, and he went to work in the coal mines when he was 7 years old. By the time he was 15, he had had quite enough of coal mining. So he did what a lot of young men did who, in his case, he had a bad family life. One of his parents remarried, and he couldn't get along with the step-parent. So he left home and he joined the army. Good thing that doesn't happen today to anybody, right?
Yeah.
He joined the army at 15, which was extraordinarily young, but he's one of the ones that doesn't fit the middle of the bell curve in the demographics. He joined the army at 15. He joined a regiment called the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Now, he wasn't a Welshman, but again, this shows the diverse demographics even of an individual British regiment. Regiments didn't recruit from individual regions, regardless of what titles the regiments had. They recruited where they could get men. So this guy from Cheshire, the young coal miner, joins the Royal Welsh Fusiliers in 1773, and almost immediately his regiment gets sent to America. While he was in the army, he learned how to read and write. As he said, one of his goals of becoming a soldier was to better himself. British regiments maintained schools because the army valued literacy a great deal. It was important to have men who could read and write to be able to do things like keep records and give orders. The army needed literate men, so it trained them in literacy. So Thomas Watson learned how to read and write as a soldier. He got to America before the war began. During the course of the war, about 3 years into it, he deserted. He ultimately settled in America, and he became a man of religion. He didn't become an actual clergyman, but he devoted himself to religion and ended up spending the rest of his life traveling around New England distributing Bibles. But I like him for a lot of reasons. One, because mainly because he shows a different kind of person than we might think of as someone who'd become a soldier, and because he opens this whole doorway to the idea of getting an education in the army. It was because of his narrative that I discovered this fact, and when I started researching, I found that, wow, there's actually a fair amount of information on this subject that nobody has bothered to assimilate and write down until now. So he's definitely one of my favorites.
So I'd like to follow up on this idea of desertion, because many of the narratives in British Soldiers' American War discuss the fact that the people that those narratives discuss deserted. So Don, can you tell us about the act of desertion and how many men deserted the British Army?
Some good questions in there, and in terms of how many men deserted, that's a difficult number to pin down. We have muster rolls that give us some data. We have some other sources. But there's a difference between a man who deserted because he was determined to get away from the army forever and a man who was charged for desertion because he wasn't at the post he was supposed to be at. So some men who were charged with desertion found themselves away from the army when that really wasn't their intention. amended things like get drunk and fall asleep or lose their way trying to get back to camp, and then got really scared that they'd be punished for being absent without leave, so they didn't come back. So then they're written off as a deserter all of a sudden. Then one circumstance or another, they get caught or they have a change of heart. They turn themselves in. They might get punished for the crime, but ultimately they remain soldiers. Well, that man was a deserter. But then there's men like Thomas Watson who couldn't reconcile being in the army with his emerging religious beliefs. And according to his own account, he started agitating among his fellow soldiers enough that he ended up having a discussion with his officers, and his officers encouraged him to desert just because he wasn't working out as a soldier. Well, he's a deserter too, but for a very different reason than the man who got drunk and couldn't find his way home. When we look at the number of men who seem to have deserted never to return, we get a number of about 7%, somewhere between 5 and 10%, and 7 seems to be where it's localizing. If we add into that an additional category of men, those who became prisoners of war, and then when the war ended, they didn't come back, that drives the number up to closer to 10%. So somewhere on the order of 5,000 British soldiers ended up remaining in America after the war, or at least deserting the army, never to return during the course of the American War. Motivations? Well, we have as many motivations as we have deserters. As I alluded to, some men deserted because they had done something else wrong and they were afraid of getting in trouble for it. Some men deserted because they married women in America, and then when it was time for the army to leave, they didn't want to leave their wives behind, and their wives didn't want to leave their families behind. Some men deserted because they formed other kinds of local attachments. They liked it here. Some men did desert because discipline was harsh. Some men deserted because, remember, it was a volunteer force. Well, some men joined the army and finally couldn't stand it, but there wasn't a simple way to leave unless you deserted, and some men took that chance. So in the spirit of a diverse population of soldiers, we also have a diverse population of deserters who are a subset of the overall population.
So there were many ways to desert, and some did it on purpose, and some did it by accident, but it's a very it sounds like a very personal experience.
Well, and that's absolutely the key to getting the pulse of the experience. Desertion was a capital crime. If you were charged, and the maximum sentence for it was the death penalty. So it wasn't something that soldiers did lightly.
So you've really given us a great overview of the British Army and a little bit about the personal experience of its soldiers. But we have just a few minutes left, so I'd like to transition into one of the other interesting things you're working on, which is the Journal of the American Revolution. You're a co-founder of that, and I'm wondering if you could tell us more about what the Journal of the American Revolution is and how you founded it.
Okay, well, the Journal of the American Revolution is a web magazine. So it's a magazine that you can subscribe to absolutely free. All you have to do is go to allthingsliberty.com and read it every day. The purpose of this magazine is to fill a terrible gap in the literature. If you want to learn about the Civil War or World War II or a number of other military conflicts, you can go out to the newsstand and get a magazine on them. Some have several different magazines. Over the years, many people have tried to start and sustain a Journal of the American Revolution or a magazine about this war, and they just couldn't do it. For one reason or another, each venture failed. It doesn't help that the audience isn't as large as it is for some of the other wars there. So seeing that gap, it actually wasn't me who founded it. I came on about 7 or 8 months after it was founded. It's the brainchild of a fellow named Todd Anderlich, who is a very good entrepreneurial thinker and a big fan of the American Revolution. And he saw this need, this space to be filled, and looked for an innovative way to fill it. clearly the print magazines weren't working out, and so what's a different business model you can create to fill the same space? A web magazine seems to be doing it. So we've been going strong for 2 years and only growing and growing over that time period.
So that was allthingsliberty.com.
Allthingsliberty.com, yep, no punctuation. Or you can just search on Journal of the American Revolution.
And are there new articles every day?
There are new articles 5 days a week, most weeks. We very deliberately don't try to keep, we don't let the production schedule get in the way of quality. So if our authors are not as busy and we have only 3 articles this week to publish, then there'll be only 3 articles. Because we'd rather have them be good, interesting articles and highly readable and fun, if we can get ones that are fun. We'd rather achieve that goal than just be determined to have a fixed number of them every single week. But most weeks, there are 5.
Great.
1 per day during the weekdays.
Fantastic. Well, we have just a few moments left, but we must carve out time for the time warp.
Okay.
The time warp. Historians can't predict the future, but they can speculate about what might have been.
This is a fun segment of the show where we ask you a hypothetical history question about what might have happened if something had occurred differently or if someone had acted differently. Are you ready for the time warp, Don?
I'll play the game. I don't know if I'll be wise enough to provide any insight. But
it's hypothetical, so there really are no right or wrong answers. But
good thing, too.
Okay, so first a little background. In British Soldiers' American War, Don mentions that while some British units recruited from the same towns and regions, regional recruitment was not a standard practice during the period of the American Revolution. So, Don, in your opinion, what might have happened if regional recruitment had been a standard practice for the British Army? Would desertion rates have been lower? Would the better cohesion of regional army units have affected the outcome of the War for Independence?
Great questions. And I think, I'm thinking about it while I'm formulating an answer, but regional recruiting came of age during the time of the American Revolution. So they went into the war without having any policies about regional recruiting. And by the time the war ended, they had introduced policies saying, well, it works really well if regiments recruit regionally, so we have better cohesion in the units. Now, this didn't reflect a problem with cohesion in the unit so much as it reflected a problem in raising the appropriate number of men that were needed. I don't think that different recruiting practices would have had a significant effect on the performance of British regiments during the American Revolution. For the most part, individual regiments behaved quite well on the battlefield. They were pretty successful militarily during the war. And it's important for contemporary Americans to remember that wars aren't always won or lost on the battlefield. So I don't think it would have had a significant impact on the war, actually. Just my opinion. But it may have helped the Army get more new recruits a little more quickly, but I don't think it would have had any actual impact on what happened on the ground in America.
Well, that's a good answer and certainly gives us food for thought.
So I hope so.
Before we conclude, would you tell us what your current research project is?
Yes, actually, I have a new book coming out in March. The book is called The Revolution's Last Men, The Soldiers Behind the Photograph. And it's a big departure for me because this is a book about American soldiers, not British soldiers. It's a book that deals with 6 men who served in the American Revolution as soldiers in the American Army and then just by chance lived long enough to have their photographs taken. They were all photographed in 1864. A book was written about them at that time, and these 6 men have remained famous ever since because of that book. But the book did not contain accurate biographical accounts of the men. It did have biographical accounts, but not accurate ones. So my new book takes the book from 1864 and enhances it by doing modern research on these men's actual lives and military careers and presenting that along with the original information that was published to give a much clearer look at these six very famous veterans who became famous because they happened to live for a really long time.
It sounds like a fascinating project that deals with historical memory as much as it does about the personal nature of war.
That's exactly correct. It's very interesting to contrast how these men recalled their military careers 80 years after they occurred with what the documents tell us their careers actually were.
Well, perhaps we can induce you to come back on the show maybe in the summer and tell us all about your new book.
I hope so. I'll be happy to do it.
So where is the best place for us to look for additional information about you, your new book, and the Journal of the American Revolution?
Well, the Journal of the American Revolution, as I said, is allthingsliberty.com. And I actually have a blog about British soldiers, which I try to maintain once a week, a new story about an individual British soldier. That's called redcoat76.blogspot.com. Again, no punctuation, just redcoat and the number 76. And if you're interested in biographies of British soldiers, that's the place to go.
Sounds great. And we will include links to those sites in the show notes page for this episode.
Yeah, superb.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Don. We've enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Our conversation with Don reminds us of the importance of considering both sides of a story. Today, we explored the British Army and the men who served in it. Knowing that the British government built its army as a professional fighting force of volunteers helps us better understand why George Washington and his eager but amateur soldiers were so outmatched, especially during the early years of the American War for Independence. Understanding the reasons why men chose to join the British Army also helps us comprehend why the Redcoats fought with such ferocity and gives us a new appreciation for the Continental Army's victory in the war. You can find more information about Don, his book, British Soldiers, American War, plus everything we talked about today on the show notes page for this episode, which you'll find at benfranklinsworld.com/010. And finally, I would greatly appreciate it if you would end 2014 and begin 2015 by rating and reviewing this podcast. Your rating and review will help us keep Ben Franklin's World visible and findable for other history lovers who may not yet be aware that this show exists. To rate and review Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history, visit benfranklinsworld.com/iTunes or benfranklinsworld.com/Stitcher.
And remember, never leave till tomorrow that which you can do today.